Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for April 20th, 2025, the cover story. Have we been thinking about ADHD all wrong? With diagnoses at a record high, some experts have begun to question our assumptions about the condition and how to treat it. This article was written by Paul Tuff. In the early 1990s, James Swanson was working as a research psychologist at the University of California, Irvine, where he specialized in the study of attention disorders. It was a touchy time for the field. The Church of Scientology had organized a nationwide protest campaign against the psychiatric profession and Ritalin, then the leading medication prescribed to children diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, was one of its main targets. Whenever Swanson and his colleagues gathered for a scientific conference, they were met by chanting protesters waving signs and airplanes overhead, pulling banners that read, "Psychs, stop drugging our kids." It was true that prescription rates for Ritalin were on the rise. The number of American children diagnosed with ADHD more than doubled in the early 1990s, from fewer than a million patients in 1990 to more than 2 million in 1993, almost two-thirds of whom were prescribed Ritalin. To Swanson at the time, that increase seemed entirely appropriate. Those 2 million children represented about 3% of the nation's child population, and 3% was the rate that he and many other scientists believed was an accurate measure of ADHD among children. Still, you didn't have to be a Scientologist to acknowledge that there were some legitimate questions about ADHD. Despite Ritalin's rapid growth, no one knew exactly how the medication worked, or whether it really was the best way to treat children's attention issues. Anecdotally, doctors and parents would observe that when many children began taking stimulant medications like Ritalin, their behavior would improve almost overnight, but no one had measured in a careful, large-scale scientific study how common that positive response was, or, for that matter, what the effects were on a child of taking Ritalin over the long term. And so Swanson and a team of researchers with funding from the National Institute of Mental Health began a vast, multi-site, randomized controlled trial comparing stimulant treatment for ADHD with non-pharmaceutical approaches like parent training and behavioral coaching. Swanson was in charge of the site in Orange County, California. He recruited and selected about 100 children with ADHD symptoms, all from 7 to 9 years old. They were divided into treatment groups. Some were given regular doses of Ritalin, some were given high-quality behavioral training, some were given a combination, and the remainder, a comparison group, were left alone to figure out their own treatment. The same thing happened at 5 other sites across the continent. Known as the Multimodal Treatment of Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder Study, or MTA, it was one of the largest studies ever undertaken of the long-term effects of any psychiatric medication. The initial results of the MTA study, published in 1999, underscored the case for stimulant medication. After 14 months of treatment, the children who took Ritalin every day had significantly fewer symptoms than the ones who received only behavioral training. Word went out to clinics and pediatricians' offices around the country. Ritalin worked. This was good news not only for families with children who struggled with attention issues, but also for the corporations that offered them pharmaceutical solutions. In the years after the study's initial publication, Swanson began consulting for drug companies. he advised Shire, which manufactured Adderall, a similar stimulant medication, on how to formulate an extended-release version of its product so that children could take just one pill each morning instead of needing to visit the school nurse's office in the middle of the day. Though Swanson had welcomed that initial increase in the diagnosis rate, he expected it to plateau at 3%. Instead, it kept rising, hitting 5.5% of American children in 1997, then 6.6% in 2000. As time passed, Swanson began to grow uneasy. He and his colleagues were continuing to follow the almost 600 children in the MTA study, and by the mid-2000s, they realized that the new data they were collecting was telling a different, and less hopeful, story than the one they initially reported. It was still true that after 14 months of treatment, the children taking Ritalin behaved better than those in the other groups. But by 36 months, that advantage had faded completely, and children in every group, including the comparison group, displayed exactly the same level of symptoms. Swanson is now 80 and close to the end of his career, and when he talks about his life's work, he sounds troubled, not just about the MTA results, but about the state of the ADHD field in general. "There are things about the way we do this work," he told me, "that just are definitely wrong." I've spent the last year speaking with some of the leading ADHD researchers in the United States and abroad, and many of them, like Swanson, express concern over what they see as a disconnect between the emerging scientific understanding of ADHD and the way the condition is being treated in clinics and doctors' offices. Edmund Sanugo-Bark, a researcher in psychiatry and neuroscience at King's College London, described the situation in personal terms. "I've invested 35 years of my life trying to identify the causes of ADHD, and somehow we seem to be farther away from our goal than we were when we started," he told me. "We have a clinical definition of ADHD that is increasingly unanchored from what we're finding in our science." Despite the questions these scientists have begun to raise, the growth of the diagnosis shows no sign of stopping or even slowing down. Last year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that 11.4% of American children had been diagnosed with ADHD, a record high. That figure includes 15.5% of American adolescents, 21% of 14-year-old boys, and 23% of 17-year-old boys. 7 million American children have received an ADHD diagnosis, up from 6 million in 2016 and 2 million in the 1990s. The preferred treatment for ADHD remains stimulant medications, including Ritalin and Adderall, and the market for those stimulants has expanded rapidly in recent years, in step with the growth of the diagnosis. From 2012 to 2022, the total number of prescriptions for stimulants to treat ADHD increased in the United States by 58%. Although the prescription rate is highest among boys ages 10 to 14, the real growth market today for stimulant medications is adults. In 2012, Americans in their 30s were issued 5 million prescriptions for stimulants to treat ADHD. A decade later, that figure had more than tripled, rising to 18 million. That ever-expanding mountain of pills rests on certain assumptions: that ADHD is a medical disorder that demands a medical solution, that it is caused by inherent deficits in children's brains, and that the medications we give them repair those deficits. Scientists who study ADHD are now challenging each one of those assumptions and uncovering new evidence for the role of a child's environment in the progression of his symptoms. They don't question the very real problems that lead families to seek treatment for ADHD, but many believe that our current approach isn't doing enough to help, and that we can do better. But first, they say, we need to rethink many of our old ideas about the disorder and begin looking at ADHD anew. ADHD has always been a controversial diagnosis. Skeptics argue that many of the classic symptoms of the disorder, fidgeting, losing things, not following instructions, are simply typical, if annoying, behaviors of childhood. In response, others point to the serious consequences that can result when those symptoms grow more intense, including school failure, social rejection, and serious emotional distress. So, where do you draw the line? How do you tell a normally rambunctious kid from a child with ADHD? The tool that clinicians use to make that distinction is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, which provides a checklist of symptoms to use in diagnosing patients, including 9 potential symptoms for inattention and 9 for hyperactivity, impulsivity. To qualify for the diagnosis, a child must display 6 symptoms from either category of sufficient severity and level of impairment for at least 6 months starting before age 12, and those symptoms must be present in 2 different settings, like home and school. That seems pretty scientific. 6 symptoms, 2 settings, 6 months, age 12. And it reflects a long-standing effort by many in the field to portray ADHD as a straightforward medical condition with clear diagnostic boundaries. Russell Barkley, one of the most prominent ADHD researchers, has labeled the disorder diabetes of the brain. And in a lecture that has been viewed more than 4 million times on YouTube, he says that like diabetes, ADHD is a chronic disorder that must be managed every day to prevent the secondary harms it's going to cause. In a recent article in Attitude, a popular magazine for families and patients, Wes Crenshaw, a psychologist who is listed as a member of the magazine's medical review panel, drew the borders of ADHD even more sharply. "Your child either has ADHD or he does not," Crenshaw wrote. "If he does have it, he is either impaired or not. And if he is impaired, talk therapy or supplements or nutrition or exercise or discipline isn't going to resolve that." Now, however, some scientists have begun to argue that the traditional conception of ADHD as an unchanging, essential fact about you, something you simply have or don't have, something wired deep in your brain, is both inaccurate and unhelpful. According to Sanugo Bark, the British researcher, the traditional notion that there is a natural category of people with ADHD that clinicians can objectively measure and define just doesn't seem to be the case. Accurately diagnosing ADHD can be challenging for a number of reasons. Unlike with diabetes, there is no reliable biological test for ADHD. The diagnostic criteria in the DSM often require subjective judgment, and historically, those criteria have been quite fluid, shifting with each revision of the manual. The diagnosis encompasses a wide variety of behaviors. There are 2 main kinds of ADHD, inattentive and hyperactive impulsive, and children in one category often seem to have little in common with children in the other. There are people with ADHD whom you can't get to stop talking, and others whom you can't get to start. Some are excessively eager and enthusiastic, others are irritable and moody. ADHD is defined in the DSM as a neurodevelopment disorder, but the symptoms of ADHD can be produced by a variety of environmental causes as well. Difficult sitting still and sustaining attention can also be symptoms of a serious head injury, fetal alcohol syndrome, childhood lead exposure, early trauma, and more. There is also a high rate of overlap between the symptoms of ADHD and those of other psychiatric disorders, including depression, anxiety, dyslexia, and autism. Although the DSM specifies that clinicians shouldn't diagnose children with ADHD if their symptoms are better explained by another mental disorder, more than three-quarters of children diagnosed with ADHD do have another mental health condition as well, according to the CDC. More than a third have a diagnosis of anxiety, and a similar fraction have a diagnosed learning disorder. 44% have been diagnosed with a behavioral disorder like oppositional defiant disorder. This all complicates the effort to portray ADHD as a distinct, unique biological disorder. Is a patient with six symptoms really that different from one with five? If a child who experienced early trauma now can't sit still or stay organized, should she be treated for ADHD? What about a child with an anxiety disorder who is constantly distracted by her worries? Does she have ADHD or just ADHD-like symptoms caused by her anxiety? To try to clarify and better define the boundaries of ADHD, researchers have long sought to identify a biological signature or biomarker for the disorder, a clear test like the blood glucose test for diabetes that would allow clinicians to say for sure which children have ADHD and which do not. And in the early years of the 21st century, it seemed as though they were on the verge of success. In 2002, Russell Barkley, then a professor of psychiatry and neurology at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, as well as the author of several popular books on ADHD, drafted an international consensus statement signed by 85 prominent researchers that defended the validity of the ADHD diagnosis. It leaned heavily on early studies that suggested that there were indeed solid biomarkers for the disorder, asserting, for instance, that people with ADHD had less brain electrical activity in certain regions than those without the diagnosis, that a single gene had been found to be associated with the disorder, and that people diagnosed with ADHD had relatively smaller areas of brain matter. In the years since the consensus statement was published, however, the evidence for each of these ADHD biomarkers has faltered. Attempts to replicate the studies that showed differences in brain electrical activity came up empty, and though scientists have identified complex collections of genes that together may be signs of greater risk for ADHD, they have failed to find a specific gene that predicts the disorder. There is no single gene story, John Gabrielli, an MIT neuroscientist, told me recently. 15 years ago, there was incredible optimism, and now we realize how far away we are. The most ambitious effort to find a biomarker for ADHD was run by the Enigma Consortium, a global network of scientists that shares brain scan data from more than 4,000 subjects. Earlier studies had found indications of physical differences in the brains of patients diagnosed with ADHD, the relatively smaller areas of brain matter, in Barkley's statement. But when a team led by Martin Hoogman, a Dutch neuroscientist, spent years comparing the cortical volume of Enigma subjects diagnosed with ADHD with those of a control group, the results were once again disappointing. Among adults and adolescents, there was no difference at all between the two groups. Among children, the differences were so minor as to be almost imperceptible. As Edmund Sanugo-Bark told me, what Enigma showed is that what we thought was there isn't really there. To the surprise of many, when Hoogman and her team published their results in 2017, they claimed that the data in fact showed the opposite, conclusively demonstrating the biological nature of ADHD. We confirm with high-powered analysis that patients with ADHD have altered brains. Therefore, ADHD is a disorder of the brain, the researchers wrote. This message is clear for clinicians to convey to parents and patients, which can help to reduce the stigma of ADHD and improve understanding of the disorder. When I interviewed Hoogman by email recently, I was surprised to learn that she now wishes she could have revised that statement. Back then, we emphasized the differences that we found, although small, but you can also conclude that the subcortical and cortical volumes of people with ADHD and those without ADHD are almost identical, she wrote. In retrospect, she added, it wasn't fitting to conclude from her findings that ADHD is a brain disorder. The ADHD neurobiology is so much more complex than that. Sanugo Bark goes further, arguing that the entire decades-long quest for a biomarker has been a red herring for the field. He understands his colleagues' desire to find airtight evidence for the biological nature of ADHD that could help them defend the diagnosis against those who would dismiss it altogether. In the field, we're so frightened that people will say it doesn't exist, he says, that this is just bad parenting from the right, or this is just a product of our post-industrial society from the left. We have to double down because we're terrified of what will happen to the kids who can't get the meds. We've seen the impact they can have on people's lives. But the reality, he says, is that there literally is no natural cutting point where you could say, this person has got ADHD and this person hasn't got it. Those decisions are to some extent arbitrary. That doesn't mean that the suffering associated with ADHD is imaginary. It just means it's on a continuum, and that is the conundrum, the empirical crisis for ADHD. The failure to find a clear biomarker doesn't mean that there is no biological basis for ADHD. Most scientists I spoke to agreed that the condition is produced by some combination of biological and environmental forces, though there is little consensus about the relative importance of each. But it does have certain implications for the field, including for the question of medication. If we're no longer confident that ADHD has a purely biological basis, does it make sense that our go-to treatment is still rooted in biology? The roots of the current treatment model go back to 1937, when a Harvard-trained psychiatrist named Charles Bradley published in the dramatically named American Journal of Insanity the results of an experiment in the clinic he ran for children with behavioral problems in East Providence, Rhode Island. For 1 week, Bradley gave 30 of his young patients a daily dose of benzedrine, an amphetamine then popular among jazz musicians and college students. 14 of the children responded in what Bradley described as a spectacular fashion. From the day of their first dose, their teachers reported remarkably improved school performance. Overnight, the students seemed for the first time interested in their schoolwork. They became more placid and easygoing, and they spontaneously made comments to their teachers like, I feel fine and can't seem to do things fast enough today, and I start to make my bed, and before I know it, it is done. Nearly 90 years later, the treatment of ADHD hasn't moved very far beyond Bradley's discovery. Adderall, now the leading treatment for the disorder, is a type of amphetamine just like the benzedrine pills that Bradley administered to his patients. The other leading prescription stimulants, including Ritalin, are all variations on the same chemical compound. F. Xavier Castellanos, a neuroscience researcher at New York University, occasionally goes back and reads Bradley's original paper, and he told me that today, when his ADHD patients take stimulant medication for the first time, he often sees the same effect that Bradley observed back in the 1930s. The first dose is almost like a mystical experience, Castellanos said. You see this transformation. The behavioral benefits are really sort of stunning, especially in younger kids. But like James Swanson, the researcher who helped lead the MTA study, Castellanos has some real concerns about stimulant treatment for ADHD. He says he is frustrated by a persistent finding in the research. While the medications can have a powerful effect on how children behave in the classroom, they do little to improve how they learn. It's a puzzle, Castellanos says. There's a real disconnect between the almost awesome effects on behavior and the minimal effects on academic achievement or attainment. What bothers me is that the kids do more seat work. You can see that they've done more problems. But then, when you test them a week or two later, their scores barely budge. Or they don't budge at all. That's the thing that really frustrates me. This effect has turned up in a number of studies over the years, but there are two relatively recent ones that illustrate it well. One was published in 2023 by Elizabeth Bowman, an Australian neuroscientist, and David Coghill, a British psychiatrist. They recruited 40 young adults in Australia, gave some of them stimulant ADHD medications and others a placebo, and then asked them to solve a series of complex tests called knapsack optimization problems. Knapsack problems are well-known puzzles in economics and computer science. You're given a virtual backpack and a series of items of different weights and prices, and you need to figure out the assortment of items that will maximize the dollar value of your load. The subjects who were given stimulants worked more quickly and intensely than the ones who took the placebo. They dutifully packed and repacked their virtual backpacks, pulling items in and out, trying various combinations. In the end, though, their scores on the knapsack test were no better than the placebo group. The reason? Their strategies for choosing items became significantly worse under the medication. Their choices didn't make much sense. They just kept pulling random items in and out of their backpack. To an observer, they appeared to be focused, well-behaved, on task, but in fact, they weren't accomplishing anything of much value. A Florida researcher named William Pelham Jr. found something similar in a study published in 2022. Unlike the Australian study, this one involved not adults but children ages 7 to 12, all attending an 8-week summer camp for kids with ADHD. Their days were split between classroom learning and regular camp activities. Pelham and his colleagues randomly divided the children into a treatment group and a control group. The treatment group got a regular daily dose of the active ingredient in Ritalin, and the control group was given a placebo. As with the Australian study, the children taking Ritalin worked faster and behaved better in the classroom than those in the placebo group. But again, they didn't learn any more than the control group. Although it has been believed for decades that medication effects on academic seat work productivity and classroom behavior would translate into improved learning of new academic material, the scientists wrote, we found no such translation. So what's going on? If these studies are accurate, stimulant medications don't do much to improve cognitive ability or academic performance. And yet millions of young Americans and their parents feel that the pills are essential to their success in school. Why? One possible explanation can be found in the work of Martha Farah, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania. In one study, she and a colleague, Irina Elieva, recruited 46 adults, gave half of them a dose of Adderall and half a placebo, and then had them perform 13 different cognitive tests. The ones who took the medication didn't do better on any of the tests than the ones who took the placebo, but when the researchers asked the subjects to evaluate their performance on the assessments, the ones who took Adderall believed they had done better. They felt more confident. even if their actual abilities didn't improve. Farah directed me to the work of Scott Vreco, a sociologist who conducted a series of interviews with students at an American university who used stimulant medication without a prescription. He wrote that the students he interviewed would often frame the functional benefits of stimulants in cognitive-sounding terms, but when he dug a little deeper, he found that the students tended to talk about their attention struggles and the benefits they experienced with medication in emotional terms rather than intellectual ones. Without the pills, they said, they just didn't feel interested in the assignments they were supposed to be doing. They didn't feel motivated. It all seemed pointless. On stimulant medication, those emotions flipped. You start to feel such a connection to what you're working on, one undergraduate told Vreco. It's almost like you fall in love with it. As another student put it, on Adderall, you're interested in what you're doing, even if it's boring. Historically, this is one of the main reasons people have taken amphetamines. They make tedious tasks seem more interesting. During World War II, the American military distributed tens of millions of amphetamine tablets to enlisted men for use during the many boring stretches of war. The pills were given to Air Force pilots flying long missions and to Navy sailors who had to keep watch all night. In the 1950s, suburban housewives took amphetamines to get through the boredom of endless days of housework and childcare. Long-distance truckers have for decades used them to tolerate the tedium of the road. For the college students Scott Vreco interviewed, term papers were just as boring as laundry or as a long-haul truck route, but they became more bearable with the help of stimulants. The original MTA study, like the later Knapsack Problem Study and Summer Camp Study, showed a strong effect of stimulant medication on behavior and next to no impact on academic achievement. Back in the early 2000s, Swanson was troubled by those results, but the bigger issue for him was the fact that even the behavioral benefits under stimulants faded out so completely. He and his colleagues spent much of that decade analyzing and reanalyzing the MTA data, and they kept coming back with the same result. After the first year of treatment, the relative positive effects of Ritalin on behavior started to shrink, and by the end of the third year, they had disappeared altogether. There was another distressing result they noticed in their data, a physiological one. The children who took Ritalin for an extended period grew less quickly than the non-medicated children did. By the end of those 36 months, subjects who had consistently taken stimulant medication were, on average, more than an inch shorter than the ones who had never received medication. Many of the scientists in the MTA group assumed that this height suppression in childhood would be temporary, that the shorter children would catch up during adolescence. But when data was collected again 9 years after the initial experiment, the height gap remained. In 2017, Swanson and the MTA group published yet another follow-up, this time tracking the subjects until age 25. The ones who had consistently taken stimulant medication remained about an inch shorter than their peers. Their ADHD symptoms, meanwhile, were no better than those who had stopped taking the medication or who had never started. Researchers acknowledge that there are other risks inherent in taking prescription stimulants. Amphetamines can be powerfully addictive, and last year a study in the American Journal of Psychiatry found that even a medium-strength daily dose of Adderall more than tripled a patient's likelihood of developing psychosis or mania. A high dose increased the risk by a factor of 5. Still, for most scientists, including Castellanos, Sonuga Bark, and Gabrielli, the positives of medication outweigh the negatives. As Gabrielli put it, I feel the bigger risk is people not getting help who are struggling in everyday life. Compared with other psychiatric medications, Gabrielli explained, Ritalin and Adderall, and the many similar formulations on the market today, are relatively safe and effective. They don't help everyone, but in the short term at least, they provide significant symptom control in most of the children who take them. Clinicians generally consider them easy to prescribe, in part because they're usually easy for patients to quit. Unlike antidepressants or many anti-anxiety medications, they don't linger in the bloodstream for more than a day, which means that even with the extended release versions, they don't require a weaning process. You can just stop taking them. At some level, Gabrielli told me, these stimulants are not that far from Red Bull. After 3 decades of studying stimulants, Swanson differs with many of his colleagues on their value. I don't agree with people who say that stimulant treatment is good, he told me. It's not good. He acknowledges that medication can often produce short-term improvements in children's behavior, but, he says, there is no long-term effect. The only long-term effect that I know of has been the suppression of growth. If you're honest, you should tell kids that, look, if you're interested in next week or next month or even the next year, this is the right treatment for you. But in the long run, you're going to be shorter. How many kids would agree to take medication? Probably none. I would like to just take a moment now to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. When I spoke to students across the country about their experiences with ADHD medication, their relationship to stimulants often turned out to be quite complex. Cap, a suburban teenager on the East Coast, told me that he began taking Ritalin the summer after his sophomore year of high school. In the affluent neighborhood where he grew up, SAT prep was an important rite of passage, and that summer his parents enrolled him in a prep course at a local tutoring center. Cap, a nickname, told me that he found studying for the SAT to be very boring, and that every time he went in for tutoring he felt unable to concentrate. Then he was prescribed Ritalin, and his experience of test prep changed. I used to hate doing the SAT reading, Cap said, but if I took the medication, I could read through it all and, like, comprehend it really well. I would actually enjoy reading it. Cap was on the varsity baseball team, and one day that fall, he went to batting practice right after one of his SAT tutoring sessions. To his surprise, he found that the medication helped with his hitting, too. I was so focused, he said. My contact rate was higher. I could see the ball better coming out of the machine. Cap had always been a very social guy, and baseball practice was usually a time to chat and joke with his teammates. But not when he took Ritalin. When I'm on the medication, I don't get as distracted socially, he told me. It feels like you're a horse with blinders on. You're just focused on your goal. There's nothing else going on in your head. Though he found Ritalin effective both for baseball and test prep, he didn't like it. Honestly, I pretty much hated taking it, he told me, but I knew I needed to for my SAT. He described for me the daily ups and downs of the medication, which affected not only his mood but also his appetite. When I take it for studying, it does feel like I'm getting an adrenaline rush, he said. I feel happy. When it peaks, you feel good about yourself. You're studying, you're locked in. But then once it wears off, you just feel awful. John, a teammate of Cap's, was first prescribed Adderall to treat ADHD in 8th grade. He told me it helped him get through his classes, especially English, which he never liked much. It would make it so that if I tried to pay attention, I would be able, he told me. It would still be very boring, but I was able to finish books and pay attention to what was happening. Socially, though, there was a price. Around my friends, I'm usually the most social, but when I'm on it, it feels like my spark is kind of gone, John said. I laugh a lot less, I can't think of anything to say. Life is just less fun. It's not like I'm sad, I'm just not as happy. It flattened things out. It was late summer when John and I spoke, and he was preparing to head off to his freshman year of college. I asked him if he was planning to take ADHD medication once he got there. He said yes, probably. He wasn't crazy about the idea, but for him it felt like a trade-off that would be worth it in the end. I kind of feel like it's just a sacrifice I'm going to have to make, he told me. For other teenagers, the negatives of stimulants outweigh the positives, and they lobby their parents to stop taking the medication, or they just quit on their own. Statistically, most adolescents don't stay on stimulants for more than a year. To Swanson, the high quit rate is further evidence that over the long term, the medications just aren't that good. If it's so effective, why do people stop? He asked. The physicians say they stop because they don't know what's good for them. So the parents hear the message, if you don't fill this prescription, you just don't know what's good for your kid. But if you ask the kids themselves, they say, it makes me feel bad, or it didn't help me, or it stopped working. Who do you believe? A significant part of the ADHD establishment does, in fact, promote the message that children and adolescents who resist medication don't know what's good for them. You encounter this point of view often when you read Attitude magazine, which is owned by the online publisher WebMD. The headline on one recent story read, "Half of college kids stop taking their ADHD medication. Make sure your teen isn't one of them." Another article by Wes Crenshaw advised parents to problematize their children's ADHD in order to encourage them to take their medication. To accept treatment, teens need to feel ADHD is problematic, as a pain in their life that limits and controls them, Crenshaw wrote. Too many parents normalize their children's struggles to make them feel better. A third article by Roberto Olivardia, a clinical psychologist who lectures at Harvard Medical School, gave advice to clinicians on how to respond if parents say they are worried that stimulant medication is muting their child's sense of humor. The suggested response? Maybe your child was the wrong kind of funny. Parents should know that not all personality changes sparked by medication are negative, Olivardia advised. If a child known for his sense of humor seems less funny on medication, it could be that the medication is properly inhibiting them. In other words, it's not that the child is less funny, it's that they're more appropriately funny at the right times. Cap's parents did encourage him to take his Ritalin every day during high school, but in reality, he told me, he used it much more situationally. By the end of senior year, he was taking medication for baseball games more often than he was taking it to study, and on weekends and in the summer, he rarely took it. John also generally doesn't take his Adderall during the summer. When he's not in school, he told me, he doesn't have any ADHD symptoms at all. If I don't have to do any work, then I'm just a completely regular person, he said. But once I have to focus on things, then I have to take it or else I just won't get any of my stuff done. John sensed that his ADHD is situational, that he has it in some circumstances but not in others, is a challenge to some of psychiatry's long-standing assumptions about the condition. After all, diabetes doesn't go away over summer vacation. But John's intuition is supported by scientific evidence. Increasingly, research suggests that for many people, ADHD might be thought of as a condition they experience, sometimes temporarily, rather than a disorder that they have in some unchanging way. Last October, the MTA group published a new study that explored how ADHD symptoms in MTA participants changed over the course of their childhood and young adulthood. In contrast to the categorical model of ADHD, you either have it or you don't, the researchers showed that for most subjects, their symptoms and level of impairment in fact fluctuated over the years, often quite substantially. Only about 11% of the children who entered the study with an ADHD diagnosis experienced the symptoms consistently year after year. More often, their symptoms would come and go. For a few years, they might stay above the DSM symptom threshold and then for a few years their symptom count might dip below the cutoff, sometimes disappearing altogether. When I spoke to Margaret Sibley, the lead author on the fluctuation study and a clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine, she pointed out for me a curious finding from an earlier MTA paper. Not only did most of the ADHD subjects improve, at least temporarily, but 40% of the children in the comparison group who were originally selected for this study, specifically because they didn't have ADHD, at some point in adolescence had enough symptoms to qualify for an ADHD diagnosis. Sibley told me she didn't believe those children somehow suddenly contracted ADHD as adolescents. Instead, she said, their circumstances, their environment might have changed, and that shift in environment might have increased their symptoms. Sibley said it was important to remember that many of the symptoms of ADHD are actually pretty commonplace. At any given moment, she explained, the average American adult has 2 or 3 of them, halfway to an official diagnosis. This isn't something that you either have nothing or you have it all, she said. That's part of why this is a gray disorder when it's not on its extremes. Those extremes, however, are very important. Conceiving of ADHD as a yes or no, black or white diagnosis, the way the profession has often done, has obscured the fact that certain children with ADHD symptoms are at much greater risk than others. Joel Nigg, a clinical psychologist at Oregon Health and Science University, has identified a number of different subtypes within the ADHD population. One group of children, those whose ADHD symptoms are accompanied by intense anger, are at much higher risk of negative outcomes than those with ADHD symptoms alone. Their early symptoms, Nick found, are often the beginning of a diagnostic cascade that leads to real problems in adolescence and adulthood, including school dropout, criminal behavior, and elevated risk of serious injury or early death. Those patients, representing about a third of the children diagnosed with ADHD, need early attention and comprehensive treatment, most likely including medications, but often going well beyond it. Nick suspects that those high-risk children do have significant biological differences from typical children, and he thinks that those differences may eventually turn up on genetic tests or brain scans as those technologies continue to improve. But for a significant percentage of people diagnosed with ADHD, Nick says, there's nothing neurobiologically notable about them. Instead, their symptoms are situational or conditional. They may have had a hard life, or they have a lack of social support, or they're in the wrong niche in life. If their problems are rooted in their environment as much as in their brain chemistry, Nick believes, then perhaps their treatment can be based in their environment as well. Sanugo Bark agrees. For most of his career, he embraced what he now calls the medical model of ADHD, the belief that the brains of people with ADHD are biologically deficient, categorically different from those of typical healthy individuals. Now, however, Sanugo Bark is proposing an alternative model, one that largely sidesteps questions of biology. What matters instead, he says, is the distress children feel as they try to make their way in the world. Sanugo Bark's proposed model locates ADHD symptoms on a continuum rather than presenting the condition as a distinct natural category, and it departs from the medical model in another crucial way. It considers those symptoms not as indications of neurological deficits, but as signals of a misalignment between a child's biological makeup and the environment in which they are trying to function. I'm not saying it's not biological, he says. I'm just saying I don't think that's the right target. Rather than trying to treat and resolve the biology, we should be focusing on building environments that improve outcomes and mental health. What the researchers noticed was that their subjects weren't particularly interested in talking about the specifics of their disorder. Instead, They wanted to talk about the context in which they were now living and how that context had affected their symptoms. Subject after subject spontaneously brought up the importance of finding their niche or the right fit in school or in the workplace. As adults, they had more freedom than they did as children to control the parameters of their lives, whether to go to college, what to study, what kind of career to pursue. Many of them had sensibly chosen contexts that were a better match for their personalities than what they experienced in school, and as a result, they reported that their ADHD symptoms had essentially disappeared. In fact, some of them were questioning whether they had ever had a disorder at all, or if they had just been in the wrong environment as children. The work environments where the subjects were thriving varied. For some, the appeal of their new jobs was that they were busy and cognitively demanding, requiring constant multitasking. For others, the right context was physical, hands-on labor. For all of them, what made a difference was having work that to them felt intrinsically interesting. One subject who was studying film in college said that his ability to thrive in his chosen field made him question the years he spent being treated for ADHD. Originally, when I was first diagnosed with it, it was explained to me as attention deficit, just a lack of attention, he said, an ability not to have an attention span for very long. But I can have an attention span for extremely long for the things that I care about. The film student reflected on his earlier struggles. Public education, you're forced into it, he said. Maybe that's why I didn't pay attention that much. But now I'm in college, in a subject that I want to be a part of. So me having a lack of attention, it hardly ever happens anymore because I'm not usually where I don't want to be. A hairstylist told the researchers that her inability to concentrate in school vanished when she began studying hair. If you sit up there and give me a lecture on a haircut, I will remember everything you said, word for word, she said. Stuff that I'm into. I am so immersed in it, but in school it was awful. A young man who was training to be an auto technician said that in his new career, his ADHD was no longer an issue. It's just that I had to figure out what I wanted to do, he explained. I want to work with cars. I don't get bored doing that. If people with ADHD are directed into areas where their strengths and interests lie, he went on, I'm pretty sure that they can naturally just go about dealing with it instead of having to give people medications. Margaret Sibley's recent fluctuations paper provided some additional clues into what might help adolescents and young adults feel better and function better. To Sibley's surprise, patients' symptoms tended to improve rather than worsen during times of higher environmental demands, periods of more responsibility and busier schedules. For many of the young men and women in the niche study, the same phenomenon held. Jobs or college courses that were demanding and interesting helped alleviate their symptoms, and as their symptoms lifted, they changed the way they thought about themselves. Rather than a static attention deficit that appeared under all circumstances, the MTA researchers wrote, our subjects described their propensity toward distraction as contextual, believing the problem lay in their environments rather than solely in themselves helped individuals allay feelings of inadequacy. Characterizing ADHD as a personality trait rather than a disorder, they saw themselves as different rather than defective. Seen through this lens, the problem for John and Cap and many other adolescents becomes a much more mundane one than a brain disorder. Their problem is the simple fact that high school can be really boring, and without medication, they have a low tolerance for boring stuff. For some children, a different school or a different kind of school might produce the same profound shift that the MTA subjects experienced when they enrolled in film school or began studying hairstyling. For others, a prescription for Ritalin and Adderall might help make school feel like a better fit. But for them and their parents, the experience of taking medication might feel quite different if it was presented to them not as a medicine to fix their defective brain, but as a tool to make an inhospitable environment more tolerable. When Edmund Sonogo Barke thinks about the way attention issues can evolve and change over the course of a person's lifetime, he often thinks about his own story. Growing up in the 1960s in Derby, a depressed industrial city in the English Midlands, he was unable to sit still in class. At 8, he was assessed with hyperkinesis and minimal brain dysfunction, the terms used at the time for what we now call ADHD. He received no treatment or medication. Instead, he was relegated to the remedial class. The only relief he found from the shame and boredom of school was with his friends, a pack of rough-and-ready young rebels who as teenagers bonded over their love of punk rock. Then, through a series of miraculous interventions, Sonogo Barke was given the chance to go to college, Bangor University in Wales, on a scholarship. When he moved to the Welsh countryside, he suddenly found himself in an environment where things were very different from everything he had known growing up. For the young adults in the niche study who were interviewed about their work lives, the transition that helped them overcome their ADHD symptoms often was leaving academic work for something more kinetic. For Sonogo Barke, it was the opposite. At university, he would show up at the library at 9 every morning and sit in his carrel working until 5. The next day, he would do it again. Growing up, he says, he had a natural tendency to hyperfocus, and back at school in Derby, that tendency looked to his teachers like daydreaming. At university, it became a secret weapon. I think my brain had probably matured to the point where I had a capacity I didn't have earlier on, Sonogo Barke told me. At the same time, suddenly I was in a context where my natural way of thinking was valuable. The combination of those two was revelatory to me. He graduated from Bangor, collected a master's degree and a PhD, and then went on to positions of academic prestige, including being elected to the Academy of Medical Sciences and named editor-in-chief of the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. I asked Sonogo Barke what he might have gained if he grew up in a different time and place, if he was prescribed Ritalin or Adderall at age 8 instead of just being packed off to the remedial class. I don't think I would have gained anything, he said. I think without medication, you learn alternative ways of dealing with stuff. In my particular case, there are a lot of characteristics that have helped me. My mind is constantly churning away, thinking of things. I never relax. The way I motivate myself is to turn everything into a problem and to try and solve the problem. Sonogo Barke says he has known plenty of young people, including some in his own family, who have benefited from taking stimulant medication. He just doesn't think it's accurate or helpful to think of Adderall or Ritalin as a medical solution to a medical disorder. Well, I'm very sorry to report that that is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program, and I was so very close to finishing this article. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.